So, this is the voice note for the reading in Inanna, Queen of Heaven and Earth, for Tuesday, April 14th. The courtship of Dumuzi and Inanna. I thought first more generally about what myth is, what our relationship to myth is. It's tempting to think of myth as something other people in other times have done and made in order to give order and structure to their world. We might think that given now to a scientific worldview, to empirical procedures for understanding how human beings work, how human societies work, how the cosmos at large works on the greatest possible scale of stars and galaxies and the minutest possible scale of subatomic particles, that we're no longer doing mythology. Mythology is something that we can see from the outside, from a remove, and gaze upon with interest, maybe some amusement, maybe a bit of condescension, or admiration, or nostalgia, depending on our disposition. I want to suggest to you a different perspective, though, and that perspective begins from the notion that it's only other people's myths that look like myths. Your own myths don't look like myths to you. They look like axioms. So let me suggest to you a couple of things that are very much part of our worldview. And if we see them from a bit of a remove, may look more myth-like than we have been given to think. The past. The future. Neither the past nor the future has any objective existence. Nowhere will you find the past, not even the instant that just passed. Nowhere will you find and be able to present the future. It does not exist anywhere. The past and the future are constructs of human mind. Our belief in them is so foundational that most of the rest of our beliefs depend upon them to even make sense at all. I submit to you that past and future, along a linear timeline, as we conceive of them, are mythic in that they are foundational and they are collaborative constructs. Nobody can make a myth on their own, but collaborative constructs of our cultural imagination. And one mark that it's myth is that we recoil from the suggestion that the idea is just a myth. So if a myth is a world-arranging story, and the figures in the myths that we are looking at are animate, they're characters, how then do we think about this reading for today of the courtship of Dumuzi and Inanna? It's more than just a boy and a girl meeting, flirting, fighting, and then getting it on. That's just the surface. We can ask what it is in the world of the Sumerians that this myth had the power to arrange, to put in order. So Inanna is the goddess of love, of war, although I don't think she's prominent in that function here, of love and fecundity and increase. Also, she has at her disposal the mei, the gifts or powers of civilization. Dumuzi is the god of the vegetation, of the spring, of rebirth. He's the classical dying and rising god. And in some contexts, he's also the god of shepherds, a pastoral god, which explains his common epithet, Dumuzi the shepherd. So what does it mean that the goddess of increase herself and the god of vegetation himself are getting it on? Well, to address that question, we can look at the terms in which they're getting it on is expressed. You may have noticed the abundance of nature imagery, of agricultural metaphors. I'm on page 37, near the top. Fortunately, this is just audio, so you can't see me blushing as I read this. Zenana speaking, "My vulva, the horn, the boat of heaven, is full of eagerness like the young moon. My untilled land lies fallow." So there's the agricultural dimension. "As for me, Inanna, who will plow my vulva? Who will plow my high field? Who will plow my wet ground?" It's all fairly thoroughly subsumed to this agricultural metaphor of the sexual act as an act of, well, of farming, of planting seed that will then grow. A little lower down, we're hearing from the narrator again, toward near the bottom of 37. "At the king's lap stood the rising cedar. Plants grew high by their side. Grains grew high by their side. Gardens flourished luxuriantly." Almost as if their sexual union either causes new abundance and growth in the natural world, or is one and the same as the abundance of spring, new growth in the natural world. The world of nature that surrounds them and the agricultural world, the fields that sustain the cities of Mesopotamia, the fields in which the natural world has been domesticated and put to human use. The fruit of their union is the whole of the green earth. So putting natural increase in terms of sexual union allows human beings to participate in natural and cosmic processes. And not just to participate in them, but in fact to influence them. The world-arranging story that is a myth has a place in it for the human teller of the story. And in fact, one thing to watch for as we encounter the myths of a number of different cultures over this course is what kind of place does the myth give to the human participant? Are human beings made focal and central? Or are they one presence among many? The Haida term for human beings, according to Robert Bringhurst, the translator of Gondel, whom we'll be reading some weeks from now, is ordinary surface bird, puncturing perhaps human pretensions to a special role in the cosmos. A passage from a book called The Intellectual Adventure of Ancient Man, and actually I've posted a link to this book on Canvas under the supplemental materials module. A passage on the ceremonial observances around Inanna and Dumuzi's marriage, I think sheds further light on the role this myth played in the cultural life of at least one of the Sumerian city-states. So the passage goes like this. I'm starting towards the bottom of page 198. And this is about the city of Isin, one of the city-states of Sumer. "The city celebrated yearly the marriage of the goddess Inanna to the god Dumuzi, or Tammuz. Since the goddess is an incarnation of the fertility of nature, and her husband, the shepherd god Dumuzi, incarnates the creative powers of spring, it is understandable that this annual union of god and goddess signifies and is the reawakening of nature in spring. So notice that dual verb. It signifies the reawakening of nature in spring. It also is the reawakening of nature in spring. The author continues, in the marriage of these deities, the fertility and the creative powers of nature themselves become manifest. But why, we may ask, should human servants of the gods, the human ruler, so it would have been the king of the city, and, so it seems, a priestess, why should they transcend their human status, take on the identity of the deities Dumuzi and Inanna, and go through their marriage? For this is what took place in the rite. You got that? So every year, early spring, the king of the city takes on the role of Dumuzi. The high priestess of the temple takes on the role of Inanna. And in a ritual, I believe most of whose details are lost to us, they, in those roles as god and goddess, consummated the marriage that ensured the return of natural abundance in spring. The author continues, having asked why they do this, he speculates, the answer to that question lies back in a remote prehistoric age, when the gods were not yet anthropomorphic rulers of states and cities, but were still directly the phenomena of nature. In those days, man's attitude was not merely one of passive obedience. It called for active intervention, as it does among many, quote-unquote, primitives today. It is one of the tenets of mythopoeic logic that similarity and identity merge. To be like is as good as to be. Therefore, by being like, by enacting the role of a force in nature, a god, man could, in the cult, enter into and clothe himself with the identity of these powers, with the identity of the gods, and through his own actions, cause the powers involved to act as he would have them act. By identifying himself with Dumuzi, the king is Dumuzi. And similarly, the priestess is Inanna. Our text clearly states this. The marriage is the marriage of the creative powers of spring. Thus, through a willed act of man, is achieved a divine union, wherein is the all-pervading, life-giving, recreative potency upon which depends, as our text tells us, quote, the life of all lands. Okay, that's a lot. All that is to say, the sexy bits are not just to make readers or listeners hot and bothered. They have a profound cosmological function. They make human beings participants in the generative powers of nature and the cosmos.